Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Welcome to Critical Mash, the revolutionary arts podcast that takes high-profile events in the arts world, turns them upside down and shakes them and sees what falls out. Today we're going to amuse ourselves by doing exactly that with probably the most popular and influential opera of all time, Carmen, a piece that bridges the gap between old-time opera and the popular arts of the 20th century musicals and films. But Carmen itself is never out of fashion. At the moment, a new staging of it is finishing its run at Covent Garden, and there's a new one running all summer at Glyndebourne. Paris Opera Comique is coming to the Edinburgh Festival with its staging, and the Buxton Festival is staging Peter Brook's celebrated pared-down adaptation La Tragédie de Carmen. And it's not just opera. Carmen's thrilling music, marvellous heroine, and violently passionate story have made it one of the world's favourite ballets. English National Ballet had a new staging back in April, and in July, Carlos Acosta presents his robust staging performed by his Havana-based contemporary dance troupe Acosta Danza at Sadler's Wells. And with us to discuss this, we are delighted to have one of the country's most eminent conductors, Sian Edwards. Sian was the first winner of the Leeds conducting competition and the first woman to conduct at Covent Garden. She was music director at English National Opera in the 90s. She has a thriving international freelance career and has been head of conducting at the Royal Academy of Music since 2013. Hello, Sian. Thank you for coming.
Hello, Robert. Great to be here and great to have the opportunity to talk about this wonderful piece.
Also joining us is a longtime colleague of mine, Anna Pickard.
Hello, Robert.
Anna was for many years music critic of The Independent on Sunday, and she continues to write about opera for The Times Literary Supplement. And she's also in charge of what I might call the intellectual side of things at Opera Holland Park. Would that be a reasonable way of...
That's a nice way of summing it up. Yes, I get people together to talk, rather like you do.
Because we didn't want to conflate intellectual and opera can sometimes seem like a contradiction in terms. However, not in your case.
No.
And my regular co-celebrant, Yehuda Shapiro, who writes about opera for the stage and for Opera magazine, and has a particular interest and expertise in French culture.
Bonjour, Robert.
Bonsoir. Bonsoir. 9 o'clock in the morning. So don't go anywhere. We'll be finding out where Carmen came from, why the Parisians completely failed to understand the opera, and how its splendid heroine spawned a whole Amazon army of femme fatale who would haunt the imaginations of men in disturbing and delightful ways, from the stories and plays of Oscar Wilde and Pierre Louis to the films of Joseph von Sternberg and Louise Buñuel. And beyond. I'm your host, Robert Thickness. This is Critical Mash, the arts podcast of The Critic magazine, the antidote to ghettoized art forms, puffery, PR and dumbing down, and the gateway to mind-expanding conversations about the things that make life worth living, even as everything collapses around our ears. So let us plunge straight in. I mean, sorry, I say straight in after my immense peroration there. Sian, it seems extremely obvious to us now that Carmen was a kind of bombshell dropped into the late 19th century opera, completely unlike anything else. Sexier, more vivid, with an entirely new kind of heroine. So before we get into when and where about that, can you tell us why you think it was so different? What makes it so different? Why it still feels so new and original?
I think the bombshell starts right at the very beginning with the prelude, and you get this absolutely fantastic, exciting music straight away, which turns out later in the opera to be a sort of précis of all the excitement that's going to happen in the build-up to the bullfight. But I think it launches the piece in a way that I can't think of very many other operas from that period do. Talking about femme fatale, I think I adore Traviata, and I think perhaps, you know, the character of Violetta already has those sort of beginnings of somebody who's got that zest for life and freedom and isn't trapped by the social mores of the time and is therefore incredibly attractive, but at the same time is trapped in the social mores of the time, and in the end, basically, they kill her. But I think that opera, for example, starts incredibly softly and beautifully and is very, very different. So this idea of throwing something on the stage straight away is very, very exciting.
The thing is that we are sort of unfamiliar with the opera comique strain. That's because it's basically the only surviving one of the opera comique, which was very popular in Paris from, I don't know, 1830, with basically forgotten composers like Auber and Boieldieu, who were wildly popular in their time. And even Auber's name is written on the roofs of every Continental Opera House you see. And he's gone, and he'll never come back.
Yes.
But the one survivor is this Carmen. But was the, I mean, is it kind of, is it representative of French opera comique in any way, do you think?
I don't know, is the answer. It's not an area that I know a great deal about. And in fact, perhaps that sums up, you know, the fact that Carmen explodes onto the stage. And I, for, you know, many reasons, perhaps have not been involved in French culture up to that point, other than through composers like Verdi, of course, Berlioz and the Trojans, which is grand opera, which is another thing altogether. But I think, doing Orpheus in the Underworld, for example, which comes from the, what is it, late 1850s, but then in 75, when this piece is being premiered, is rehashed in a big opera style, you know, but it's nothing like this, even though it's raunchy and sexy. But, you know, the idea that they're taking real people in the real time, actually, I think one can say, and that makes also the characters in the opera read to us today, just like characters in Bohème. It really is verismo, I would say. I think a fascinating thing is the way Bizet is, and probably his librettists, are so brilliant in controlling the temperature. So you get this explosion of sound at the beginning, then you get the mystery of the flower motif, which is this flower that Carmen throws at Don Jose right in, early in the opera, that he picks up, and it's the kind of, if you like, the magic and the mystery that then affects the way he's going to behave in the whole of the rest of the piece. But you then go into the opening scene in the city square. Everyone's incredibly bored, it's hot, it's tiring, the army kids. So we, of course, don't have conscription anymore here, but a lot of European countries still do. And, you know, these conscripted soldiers hanging around, just waiting for the guard change. And then Micaela comes in and they actually rough her up a bit. They're not very nice, they taunt her. But it's all done in very low key. So you get this sense of people being hot and bored. And then there's the guard change. While, and here's again a brilliant little bit of staging. You have the children's chorus coming on. The kids, ruffians, come in and actually sort of make a kind of mockery, if you like, of the soldiers actually changing the guard with their very, very beautifully set little number. So again, what's not to like? You know, you've got an opera with soldiers. You've got the lovely young girl who's going to, you know, later on be praying to God to save her from the difficult circumstances she's in. You've got kids choir, so, you know, that's also very attractive. And that sets the scene then for what's going to happen next.
Which is then a kind of air raid siren, and Carmen comes in.
Well, not quite, though, because you get the smoking chorus.
Oh, the smoking chorus, the smoking chorus.
Yes, and so this is, but this is where I think Bizet is so, again, brilliant, because you get this incredibly sensual music. And he's almost writing music as if the smoke itself is curling up through the air. And the factory gates open, and all the women who are working in the factory, where it's also staggeringly hot, rolling cigarettes and cigars, they come out for a break, and all the guys who've been looshing around in the square ogle these women, who of course aren't wearing very much because it's so hot. So you get this sense of them going, oh, come on, girls, you know, give us a look and all this. So again, it's quite sort of louche and bawdy, and I can understand why, if the opera comique was seen as a place where you took your, I think read somewhere, you took your newly engaged girlfriend for a nice night out, you know, and there you are suddenly seeing all this kind of louche behaviour and quite a lot of, again, taunting of people. And then the guy's saying, but where's Carmen? And then she comes in, and then you get the habanera, and she seduces all the men And I think that's another really interesting part of the opera, is the fact that it's not just Carmen and Jose, but she's the main girl that everybody wants. So, you know, all the men say, oh, Carmen, look my way, come on, give me something. And so you get all this in the music, these little moments of conversation, and it's as if the camera suddenly goes close up on a couple of men in the chorus going, oh, Carmen, come on, give me a smile, give me a smile, you know, and but she's like, huh, you know, and then she goes into Love's a Bird, you know, and you can't tie it down. And so again, immediately with this habanera establishing this fantastic freedom that she has, which other people don't.
And I mean, it's her manifesto, and unfortunately José is not listening when she sings it, because if he was, it might have saved a good deal of trouble, because yes, she tells him exactly what's basically going to happen if you make the mistake of getting mixed up with her. Merimée, the writer of the story, who we're going to come to later, really liked setting his things in exotic places. And exotic, you know, didn't have to be Egypt, but he would do that as well. But Corsica, south of Spain, all these kind of things, where you know, kind of violent love and death under the under the pitiless sun was doing its thing. And people were, you know, kind of primitive, basic, and lived as humans are supposed to live, without the veneers of civilization and all this kind of thing. And Bizet also loved exotic, because he'd already written
The Pearl Fishers,
and then Jamila, yeah. And which were kind of, because he'd done them before, they looked like test runs for Carmen, because Pearl Fishers is kind of, it's set in Ceylon, right? Yeah. But it could be anywhere, because the music is just kind of generalised exotica, and with a few kind of Eastern scales. But when we get to Spain, I mean, you know, clearly Spain is kind of part of this other Oriental kind of, the Oriental obsession of particularly French culture at this time, which was basically a kind of an imaginative projection of sexual fantasies.
Well, it's heat.
Where anything goes. Heat and barely clothed women who may or may not be available, or probably are, in the imagination of the writer. I mean, it was a big thing.
And also gypsy culture, which actually still exists. I remember giving some concerts in Granada, and there was a lovely man playing in the second violins who himself was of gypsy background, and so he was living in the gypsy quarter of Granada, and he was saying, you know, if people who try to park their cars in that area are not known to the local people, they'll let their tyres down or even take the car away, you know. So
just
there's
like Birmingham,
still,
in fact.
Well, maybe you're right, yeah. But also, you know, because it was so, it is so, in Granada, it's so hilly and so on, of course. We know the Alhambra is up a hill, but also a lot of the other areas are up hills. They're still using mules to carry the bricks to build the houses, you know, and everything. So it's still got that sort of vibrancy in some way.
And there's this thing, what you were saying about the, you know, like within 5 or 10 minutes, Bizet has given us, you know, a whole bunch of different stuff. And nobody's ever done this before, all this different stuff, as a kind of dramatic compositional technique. He's not doing kind of thematic development or anything. He's just doing bang, bang, bang. I mean, someone called it a mishmash of kind of unblendable styles, which is a matter of taste. I mean, we now think it's brilliant, right? Yeah. And it seems to work very well because it has such impetus. It gives us all the kind of atmospheres that we're going to see throughout the show on a plate, basically in the first 5 minutes. And then it kind of works itself after that. But this is a totally new kind of way of writing music as drama.
And it's incredibly, tightly composed, actually. So the other thing is to recognise that it is a brilliant work of composition. So, for example, you've had the girls arrive, they're doing their smoking, and the men are ogling them, and then some of the basses say, but where is she? You know, where's Carmen Sita? And then you get diddle-a-lum, bum-bum, diddle-a-lum, dum-dum, diddle-a-lum, ba-ba-beep-ba-ba-da, there she is! And that's actually the Escamillo music as well. That's the going to be the Toreador. Again, you know, very, very much sort of carefully sort of constructed.
I think one thing we haven't mentioned is the fact that the opera comique tradition involves spoken dialogue as well, and I think that's quite important. So in a sense, although the overture makes that mishmash completely coherent, there is perhaps less pressure to make each scene connect when you know that you're going to be sort of chit-chatting a little bit between numbers.
You know, what people like about Carmen, arguably, is this whole Seville tourist board thing. And Seville Tourist Board loves it because they're always putting on like open air versions down there. And it's become, you know, it's amazing. So hilarious, this French music, this kind of French caricature or parody of Spanish music has become the representative sound of Spain, which is weird.
I have a question, and I think maybe Yehuda would be the person to answer this. Is it the first opera in which all of the principal characters are essentially quite poor?
Well, that's, I was just thinking...
Certainly working class.
Yes. But in an opera comique, that probably wasn't such a new thing, was it? I mean, or in opera buffo.
According to himself.
He's a Don.
Yeah.
Well, I think Don is like being dottore in Italian.
No. He makes a point in the story that he's an old hidalgo.
In the Basque country, he's kind of.
He's a big cheese. He's a big cheese in Basque country.
But hasn't he killed somebody?
Yes, but that was okay because it's an honour killing. I mean, the thing, you know, honour killing is okay, right? I mean, the whole of opera is about honour killing. It's just that now it becomes honour killing, as you say, among lower classes. Or no, because he's going to be garrotted rather than hung.
Yes.
Because he's posh. Yes.
Oh, is that preferable to being hung?
Yes, it's more honourable to be garrotted. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
It's worth the.
But he does say, doesn't he? I'm Don Jose of Navarre, and I'm here because I killed a man, but I was going to be a priest. So that's interesting too, isn't it? He's going to be a priest.
He's sort of an outlier in kind of class terms as well, right? He's part of this sort of colonial army which is looking after Seville, which is sort of an outpost. And then his music. So there's an idiom that Bizet uses when Micaela, the girl next door, turns up and starts singing, trilling these lovely French opera comique.
Yes.
Kind of standard tunes, but very nicely done, very nicely orchestrated, lots of kind of translucent harmonic shifts and this kind of thing. You know, do we know who José is by the way that he sings?
I don't think we do, actually. No, I think you're absolutely right that he basically joins in with Micaela. So they're both from a nice place, and she's sent by his mother to talk to him and to give him a kiss from his mother, which, of course, she being, you know, in love with him herself, does. And Bizet does the most gorgeous music, and you feel almost like, you know, as she bends towards him to plant this kiss on his forehead, that there's this sort of wonderful sense of revelation and frisson, perhaps for her. And then he goes on, though, just singing, oh, yes, I remember our wonderful place and a beautiful time, but he never really says to her, you know, and I think I'm going to marry you. So she's always left a bit dangling. And this long duet they have where they go backwards and forwards singing to each other is very lovely, but probably much more the kind of thing you'd have at the Opera Comique than Habanera, for example.
Just to go back to the flower song, I was thinking about it. That really has got nothing to do with the Don José you see in the book, because he's very banal in the Mérimée, and I sort of think the flower song really lifts him into a different realm.
It
does definitely make him more heroic and more romantic.
Definitely,
whereas in the book, really, he's a bit of adult, and I think that's very interesting, that the way that shifts the whole balance of our understanding of the characters.
But are we overthinking this? Is he not just being given some lovely music? Because if you present him purely as adult from the beginning, why should anybody engage with him?
But I think it's interesting in that act too. That is absolutely the turning. I always think what's so brilliant is the whole act turns on that aria, because before that it's been sort of rather fun, and suddenly things get serious at that point, and the relationship between him and Carmen becomes much more intense at that point. And I just think it's brilliant.
I agree, because I think the music is so strongly personal from him and really true. I mean, he's really telling her, look, I absolutely adore you and I've got to be with you. And so he really sort of lays his heart out, if you like, to her. And of course, she's not going to buy it. So the sort of heartbreak at that moment is that she's going to walk away, actually. She doesn't get any of this. So she just says, well, you know, too bad.
Well, I'm not sure about that, Sean. I think what happened, I mean, there are a couple of things. Because at the end of the flower song, there's this amazing cadence, right? That the music can't find the tonic.
Yeah.
And he goes, je t'aime, very up high. And the orchestra is kind of wandering around the keys, trying to find its destination.
Yes.
And you think, oh my God, this guy's lost. And you know, this is real, the real thing. He really is in love. Yeah. And then Carmen says, "Non, tu ne m'aimes pas," you do not love me, with her little tritone.
Yes.
And at this point, just using him, she's saying, "If you did love me, you would do such and such." And then he does it. So that's kind of well-known ploy that you did not love me. I would argue. I do think so. I think it's not unheard of.
I just take it serious. I think she's just not interested in what is, to me, a very 19th century romantic song. And she's from another kind of style altogether, if you like. And she's just not going to be seduced by this lovely 19th century romantic song. She's going to keep going with her habanera, you know.
I mean, you know, I have a very high opinion of Carmen, as all men should. obviously, but, you know, this is the thing about the femme fatale. There's the woman for whom it's really worth, you know, she's going to destroy you, but it's okay because it's worth it. Possibly the starting point of this was Matthew Lewis's book, The Monk. There's this monk called Athanasius, and I think his name is, and he is bewitched by a kind of extremely attractive witch who comes and seduces him in the monastery. And he says, "Come, enchantress, come and ruin me." And this is basically the essence of the whole femme fatale thing, right? This is that you will your own destruction. Man wills his own destruction at the hands of this irrestible woman.
I think that takes away Carmen's power. I think she's a much more powerful person who's just saying, "You're weak and I'm not interested in you."
I think she's a cool chick. I don't think she's a seductress. She just is.
Unfortunately, that is what men see, but I think she's much more her own person, actually.
Well, and I think that's right, but all I'm saying is that from his point of view, that's what he wills his own destruction, and then blames her for it.
Whose body's left on the floor at the end? Yeah.
Well, he's about to die as well. I mean, it's true that she does die.
Yes, but that's not that we see. You know, she does die. She doesn't die.
No, she does. She does die.
But by him.
But for 3 hours, she's very much alive. I know it sounds like Mrs. Lincoln and the theatre, doesn't it? But
she had a great time until she was dead.
She'll come back tomorrow to sing again. I mean, you know, that's not.
But I do think though as well that there's a depth to Carmen, as there is actually to Violetta in Traviata, that it's perhaps easy to miss. So when they do the card trio, which is this amazing number in Act Three, where her two best friends, Fresquito and Mercedes, they're dealing the cards, they're in the mountains, they're going to be about to do some smuggling, and they're just kind of biding their time. So they do some cards to see their fate, and you know, they want to see who they're going to marry. And then there's this amazing music when Carmen turns over her cards and realizes it's death.
It's dry as dust, isn't it? Suddenly, it's
L'amour, and she's got this, and also Bizet using the real bottom of her voice, you know, to get this sort of dark, deep sound. And I think that she knows, in a way, a lot more about what's going on than anybody else in the opera. And I think that, as to me, also gives me a sense of her much greater strength and spirituality, actually, than any of the other characters, including Don Jose, who I think pales into insignificance compared to her.
It's totally true. I mean, what people remember about Carmen is Carmen. I mean, totally. She's the attraction. I mean, the show itself is the attraction, but she is absolutely the... Nobody else counts, yeah.
I would like to say also, I think she's fairly remarkable amongst the big canon of really, really popular, indestructible operas, although plenty of people try to destroy them, in that she has female friends. And that's remarkable. You just don't get that. It's the thing that always bugs me about the Poulenc.
Lavoie-Humaine.
I do not believe that friendship at all. The one that she has down the phone, because her best friend would be around there. Instantly, the opera would be over.
The trouble is, they're not very nice people in Lavoie-Humaine, none of them, including Elle. But that's...
Sorry, I've gone way off topic, but I do think it's interesting that there is a close connection between her and Mercedes and Frasquita.
But also there's something interesting about the card number is that it's the only time she's not singing for someone, isn't it?
That's
Am
true.
I right?
That's, I think you're very right.
That's the only time she's somewhat looking looking inwards.
It's certainly the first time we get that, because everything else is, like you say, it's a performance. You know, they're dance forms. This is an aria.
So tell us about Escamillo, Anna.
Well, I would just say that his entrance aria is possibly the most charismatic entrance aria that there is for a baritone, bass baritone. Everyone is applauding him. He arrives as a hero. He arrives with glamour. And then in the song, which describes the excitement and the course of a bullfight, I mean, essentially, you've got the whole drama compressed into that, because, you know, someone has to die at the end of it. And I think that the fact that he's setting out that narrative, we tend to overlook it because it's just so enjoyable. We tend not to pay attention to the details. But essentially, in that scenario, it could be him versus Carmen. It could be Carmen versus Don José. You know, who is the bull? Who is the bullfighter? It is so clear when he arrives that he is the man for her. She has made the wrong decision, you know, sort of with Don José. She has to go with Escamillo.
And when they eventually do get together and they have the love duet outside the bullring, it's so boring.
It's true, there is an element that suddenly they seem to be settling down to a sort of propriety.
Yes.
A conventional...
But he's kind of brainless. I mean, he's a sort of brainless masculinity, I think, Escamillo.
And the thing is that his
song is brilliant, I agree, and also has the same kind of... I don't know whether it's a coincidence, but it has the same kind of falling shape that the habanero has. It goes down.
It's got a couple of verses as well.
It goes down an octave in a very short space of time, as the habanero does. And then, I mean, I think, you know, of course, the problem with, if there is a problem with Carmen, is that what the tune that everybody remembers is the blasted chorus of that, which is awful. And Bizet repeats four times, which seems at least one time more than necessary.
It's a great tune.
Well, I bet the verse is much better than the chorus.
The verse is much better than the chorus, but you can say that of Gershwin. I think it's a slightly redundant criticism.
Well, maybe it's
a,
but no, it's just the four times.
And also, I think you're kind of wrong about him. I mean, you're painting him as adult. But
well,
I've
been wrong about Carmen, and now I'm wrong about Escamillo. You know what is
he's,
this?
He does listen to what she wants, which is what the other one does not do.
But also, presumably, it's a bit of a deal because, I mean, he probably is a serial seducer, and she is as well. So they sort of understand each other.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. There's no idea that they're going to have like a long and fruitful relationship.
But that's part of the deal, which is much healthier in terms of the dramaturgy than the relationship between Carmen and José, isn't it? Mm.
And also, he's involved, isn't he, as well, with fighting and death, you know, and black and white. So she is too. I think, you know, so the two of them have that in common as well.
The fatalism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the question is fate. Sian, you referred to the, I think, the you said the flower.
Yes, motif, absolutely. Which
is that what we call
plays?
the Right, so which other people call the kind of doom motif or the fate motif that happens at the end of the overture, because it, you know, come on with tremolo strings and D minor and all this kind of thing, and very deathy. And you call it the flower motif, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, because I think when she throws the flower at him, it comes on.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's very much the same flavour of Don José's song to her in the second act. And this idea also, talking about the music, that Bizet then writes these very dark, flat keys as opposed to the brilliant G majors and C majors. So you get this much more sort of internal colour to the sound.
Was that quite an innovative device, Sian, on Bizet's part? I mean, do you think there's precedent for it?
I think composers have done that, you know, a lot. I mean, Mozart and Schubert certainly liked their flat keys for when they wanted something that was softer and more internal. So it's a kind of known thing, but I think the fact that Bizet, obviously brilliant musician, amazing composer, was able to use all these devices in this piece, you know, just again brings another angle of colour and brilliance to it.
And in terms of the little motif as well, I mean, was that something that people had used much before? I mean, I'm
just trying to think. I'm sure it does come, but
it's almost like the Symphonie Fantastique, isn't it? Actually?
Yes, exactly. Yes, which is of course, yeah, 1820s. So yeah, that idea of selling something to us, which
I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's a sort of simple and, like, in hindsight, it's an obvious idea. But the brilliant thing is using it twice. First as her alarm call, and then secondly as the, you know, way, three octaves down as the doom motif. I was thinking of the reception of this at the Opera Comique, which was supposed to be these lovely romantic comedies and I was trying to think of an equivalent, and I was thinking, like, maybe in 1968, if instead of putting on, like, Norma at Covent Garden, or the audience turned up, and instead of seeing Norma, they saw Hair, the musical. and I kind of feel that there's this kind of equivalent, you know, they can imagine the 1968 Covent Garden audience suddenly being with songs about masturbation and things.
I do wonder whether it was slightly cooked up, though, because a lot of the moral concerns about Carmen were sort of fed to the press in the weeks before its opening. You know, there were people resigning and so forth. And of course, we have a model for that in the way that the London premiere of La Traviata was also cooked up into a kind of moral storm, with letters to the Times and so forth. I mean, it's a way of guaranteeing a box office.
And it works with Calixto Beato shows now.
Yeah.
There's going to be sex. And I mean, they did, it was not long ago, wasn't it, the Ballo and Mascara? They said, oh, we've got a line of toilets opening.
That's 20 years ago.
But when I say these days, I mean, you know, so, I mean, I was, obviously we were all young and fresh then. But you know, it's not so long ago, right? And I remember the preview saying it's going to open with this kind of line of bogs on stage. And everyone was like, oh, isn't that dreadful? And then they bought tickets.
Yes, but you talk about Beato, and as far as I'm concerned, you know, his staging of Carmen, which, you know, has been seen, I don't know in how many houses now, all over the place, and in London here at ENO at least twice, maybe thrice, that for me is the one that absolutely nails every element of this opera.
I mean, the thing is that we've talked about this, that we quite rarely see productions of Carmen that we think are successful, and I can kind of remember two. I don't really particularly like that Beato one, but I remember the McVicar one at Glyndebourne when it had a realistic cast. Well, I think it was better without Anne-Sophie.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was thinking about this morning on the way here, and I think that I've probably seen lots of incredibly good Carmens, as in the female singer who is singing that role, but not so many good, very few, in fact, good Carmens, as in the opera, the production.
And, you know, is there a problem? I mean, it doesn't seem to. I mean, some people could talk about the, you know, hasn't got a love duet. Well, kind of has, actually. It's got two. And it's too, you know, there's José is a weak character, but he's sort of all right. And Act Three is a bit of a mess, well, I, you know, arguably. But there's no obvious reason why it shouldn't work.
I think it's to do with exoticism, isn't it? I think people either overlay it or underplay it.
I think the production that exemplifies what's wrong with people's attitude towards Carmen was the Kosky one that was seen at Covent Garden, because it was saying, oh, everyone's bored with Carmen, let's do something different with it.
This is the one with the gorilla costume.
The one with the gorilla. It was very like a big West End show with the steps and lots of it. And Barry Kosky may be a bit bored with Carmen because he's seen it too much, but audiences are probably not bored with Carmen because they've seen
it. No, the people with the kind of wedding anniversary crowd at Covent Garden
Not even the wedding anniversary. I mean, I haven't seen Carmen that often. I think it's an absolute masterpiece, but I haven't seen it that often. And it would be nice to see a show, for me, which did it on the Opéra Comique scale with the dialogue.
You can go to Edinburgh and see it, because then you also get French people who might be able to deliver the dialogue okay. Most singers are very bad at delivering spoken lines, and most of the what they call the melodrama or the dialogue in Carmen is always very badly delivered.
I would like to put in a word here for Anna Caterina Antonacci, who can definitely do both, and who even managed to steal the attention from Polly the donkey in Francesca's.
But the trouble was with that production was she was played so overly sexy. Caterina Antonacci's got a fantastic stage presence, but she was asked to play Carmen with sort of hips, legs and arms akimbo all the time, and you know, boobs falling out. It was a very obvious production, that one, and I thought that really kind of, it would have been nice with a singer of that stature to have played Carmen as a bit more of this cool chick with a bit of dignity, which I think she has.
But there doesn't seem to be halfway house.
Cleavage is kind of part of the deal. I mean, I certainly remember it in her Rodelinda.
Well, I didn't see the Rodelinda, but I saw that production. I thought it just played to every possible cliche you could ever want.
But at least it's unembarrassed. I mean, you know, because the thing you get, the feeling you get these days is that people are embarrassed about Carmen. It also has exoticism, things you have to apologise for, gypsies, and, you know, caricatures of Spanishness, caricatures of everything. And they get, and then you wind up getting the Kosky version because everyone's like too frightened to put on Carmen. I mean, what are the interesting thing about opera and Carmen, let's say, is that, you know, if Carmen was a 19th century play, like, you know, Tosca or something by Scribe or something like that, one of these kind of things, it would be completely forgotten. The reason that Carmen is remembered at all is because it's an opera, and therefore it's remembered because of its music, because 19th century dramas have vanished. And this presents an opportunity and a problem, right? Because you've got these things which are absolutely of their time being performed now for a completely different sensibility, a completely different culture. And, you know, a lot of the assumptions that a piece like Carmen makes are, frankly, kind of embarrassing now. And it's fun to look back on the past and think how much better we are than what they were then and all this kind of thing. But
I don't think about that at all. I think the piece speaks to us today as strongly as it must have done then.
No, it can do.
Because it has got this mystery. I mean, we were mentioning earlier Don Giovanni, actually, who also is a character that's a little bit elusive, and it's very hard to stage that opera successfully, I think. And it's very hard to stage Carmen perhaps successfully for the same reasons. But I think that the actual situation speaks to people directly.
No, the core of it, absolutely, the core of it. I'm just saying, but objectively viewed, clearly some people do. Okay. Like at Covent Garden, they feel embarrassed about doing it. So, you know, Oliver Mears was going on about, you know, oh, we do know what Carmen is, this is why we have to do it on a staircase.
Right.
which was a poor excuse. But opera is the only thing, apart from, like, you know, Shakespeare, that we are still reinterpreting 150 years, 200 years, 300 years after it was written. Everything else has basically vanished. You know, a few plays by Ibsen and Chekhov, this kind of thing. But basically everything vanishes. Opera preserves these things in aspic. And, of course, if the core of them wasn't fascinating and eternally renewable, then we wouldn't be doing them. But this is, that's why it's the opportunity, as well as the you know, you feel sometimes you have to kind of change the framing of it to do it, and reinterpreting. I mean, there have been a million reinterpretations of it. In the old days, people thought that the story of Carmen was an honourable, poor, honourable, simple soldier undone by an unreliable, dreadful devil woman. And we don't kind of tend to think that now. We tend to look at it a bit different. So that's, you know, a reflection of the way that we've changed our opinions about various matters. But there are a million ways of doing it. The Soviet Union in 1920-something, there was a production when Carmen was a kind of freedom fighter. In Nazi Germany, there was a production which very much reinforced the racial stereotyping and how bad it was. You know, so it can be endlessly viewed from a million different prisons.
I love that. I think that's one of the real big attractions. But as you say, the through stream all the time is the music, which doesn't go away and doesn't really change, actually, even though the interpretation of it can change. But the melodies are still there and we still can engage. And I think one of the amazing things about this opera is that every number's a winner, you know, whether it's one of the solo numbers or whether it's the duets or whether it's indeed what you mentioned, Robert, much earlier, the presence of the chorus, who have these amazing numbers. You know, I was just thinking the end of Act Two when the chorus all come on to rescue Carmen, you know, and then they talk about La Libertà, you know, and you get this amazing chorus. And I must say, I always leave the auditorium at that moment thinking, I want to be free like this. I want to go ahead. I want to, you know, go to the mountains immediately. There's something incredibly inspiring and exciting about it. Exactly, yeah, yeah. And certainly conducting it, you feel that as well. This build that he gives, again, a few voices at first and then more and more, and then, you know, it builds and builds.
And it goes with such a swing. It really
does. It's fantastic, yeah. Yeah.
Before, I know that you have to run away, Shan, but I just wanted to ask you about the last scene. And
it is unbelievably intense, watching these two people absolutely just destroying each other for 5 minutes of the... How does that work musically? How does he do it?
Well, so I think what's another amazing thing about the whole opera is that it starts off with quite standard numbers interspersed with speech, as Anna was talking about. And so there's quite a lot of interesting different musics, but you have then the speech in between, which basically speeds up the process of the action. But then as you go through the opera, there's less and less speech and more music connecting, so that by the time already you're in the end of the third act, the music is moving forward and itself then carrying the drama. Because I think one of the interesting things when you do an opera, as Anna was mentioning, with recitative, for example, any of the Mozarts, most of the drama happens in the recitative, and then the characters sing about their feelings or, you know, what's about to happen, until you get to the amazing Mozart finales, where he will then string one bit after another and give us this incredible sort of compendium of ideas. So in a way, what Bizet is doing is similar here, in that you get the last act and there is no more dialogue, and it, or the dialogue is done sung rather than spoken. And so you get this, as you were saying, Robert, incredibly intense forward motion that's powered by the music. And it starts off with, again, this incredibly sunny, you know, and then the procession of the picadors and the toreadors. And so you get this big public statement going on and everybody very excited. And then, again, it's as if the camera goes close up onto Jose and Carmen, and you get this very intimate music. And she's almost sort of resigned. You know, she says, "Oh, you're here." And he says, "Yes, I'm here." You know, and so, the again, Bizet takes the temperature right down for a moment and lets you sort of believe. I mean, I always think when I'm conducting this that she might walk away this time. And, you know, it's got, you've got to have that sense as well, that this is not a given moment. And of course the brilliance of then of the bullfight going on in the background, so you get the life and death happening there and all the cheers of the crowd. But and that's again an incredibly complex construct musically, you know, where you've got the offstage crowd, you've got the offstage band and the orchestra and all the excitement going on, and then you've got the two main characters at the front of the stage having this incredibly intense altercation. And as I say, you know, I always think when I'm performing this that, you know, maybe she's going to be okay this time, because she does literally walk away and he stabs her in the back. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not even as if they have a fight. She just says, you know, I'm leaving now. Mm-hmm. And it's an amazing thing to see that. And I remember the Jonathan Miller production I was involved with, where he got her to walk sort of forwards towards the audience. And she, it's almost as if she's daring him to do something. And of course, in a way, the weakness of Jose is that he can't walk away. He has to actually destroy her. And so, yeah. And it's done in full... I mean, one of those things, you know, that I gather the opera comique was shocked about was this murder happens in full light at the front of the stage, you know. And so it's always shocking. It's always, I find, deeply shocking when it actually happens.
Yes, I mean, but also you can. I mean, it's inevitable, right? I mean, from the moment that they see each other, as you say,
yes,
and
yes,
she says, "You're here." I think we know where we're going,
yes,
and she knows where we're going.
Yes, yes.
She's been warned,
yes. and she's warned herself, and she said, "You know, first him, first me, then him."
Yes,
death. When she's reading her, I mean, I. Can't,
but the
I'm
girlfriends
sure I,
say as well, don't they? Going back to Anna's point, they say
that,
yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they know something.
I'm not sure I agree with you about the cards, Sian, because, you know, I don't really believe in card fortune telling. I think that Carmen would see death in any hand of cards, including Animal Snap. She would get like a kangaroo and say, "Oh my God, it's death again. It's a the fluffy bunny, death, la mort." And that's her kind of thing. But of course, there have been, I mean, you know, people do different endings. I mean, sometimes Carmen stabs Don José these days. Sometimes Micaela, I think in the Peter Brook, Micaela kills Carmen.
Just talking about endings, I have wonderful friends who for years have done opera for young people. And what they do is go into schools, and then Carmen is one of their favourite things to do. And then they do a sort of hour version of Carmen. But then they get the young people, usually secondary school school kids to write their own versions of Carmen, mm-hmm. and quite often, actually, yeah, Carmen turns around and stabs Don Jose. And I think that's great.
Power.
Exactly. So, you know, it shows that, again, you can think about the piece in many different ways.
But that would also be bad if she stabbed Don Jose.
It would be, yes, absolutely. But except that, in a way, that would then ensure her freedom, perhaps.
I cede to my significantly younger female colleagues on this, one of whom said, well, men kill women every day for no good reason.
Yeah. So just one for the team, is that what you're saying?
No. Shame on you.
Well, no, so what are you saying? I don't understand.
No, that it's a realist opera.
Yeah. Oh, I see, right. Yeah.
That it's not fantasy, it's just realist.
Well, the ending kind of partakes of realism, yeah. I mean, obviously that it's also a fantasy. I mean, the Mérimée story is a fantasy, Bizet's thing is a fantasy, and I think we should talk about that when we've allowed Chan to.
Okay, thank you very much.
It's so amazing that you came. Thank you so much.
In connection with the final scene, I think what's interesting is that it becomes a ritual, and that ritual is explicit in the bullfight as well. And I think that's something that opera is probably the only art form that really does ritual anymore. Opera is about a ritual in a sense, as an art form these days to some degree. And I think it's interesting that Sean was saying that she always thinks Carmen's going to possibly walk away in the final scene. It's a bit like going and seeing Tosca. Is another example. Tosca is always exciting. You always think, what's going to happen with the execution? Because it's in the score and it's set out, there's comparatively little freedom in an opera as opposed to, say, a play or a film because of the music, that there is this sense of a ritual that goes with it, which is quite compelling.
Isn't it a little bit like watching Casablanca again, or watching Brief Encounter again, or watching It's a Wonderful Life again, or Citizen Kane, or The Third Man? You might want something to turn out slightly differently, or you might absorb a different angle this time, but you know essentially what's going to happen. I mean, I would give anything to go back to a completely uneducated first view of some of these classics. I would love to experience that with somebody not having told me anything about what I'm going to see before I see it.
As you say, Anna, you know, the first time we've had basically working class people on stage killing each other rather than posh people, which is that is kind of the precursor of the verismo, the realism, the so-called verismo, soi-disant verismo thing. Because how realistic was verismo anyway, all that kind of stuff, yes? But Mérimée is really not, you know, Zola or Verga. Mérimée is absolutely a kind of fantasist writer. It just happens that this rather realistic thing happens in it among working class people. It's fine. But I also think that verismo opera, as it sort of devolved through early 20th century Italy, was absolutely the precursor of cinema. That was...
I mean, we're talking for, what is it, sort of like about 1893 or 91 or something like that, when we get Cavalleria Rusticana based on Verga. But the influence of Zola, I think you can hear probably in this, maybe, you know, diluted a little bit.
A kind of interweaving of the arts is always interesting, right? And particularly interesting. I mean, this was an incredibly fruitful time in French culture, although it was also an incredibly traumatic time because they just had the Franco-Prussian War 5 years earlier and the Commune in Paris, which resulted in something like 20,000 people being shot in the streets by government forces. And then this interestingly, of course, Paris had just been rebuilt by Baron Haussmann to make shooting people in the streets a good deal easier because the streets were all lovely and wide and straight. So you could fire a cannon from, like, opera and kill someone 4 miles away, or kill a crowd 4 miles away at République. It's absolutely brilliant. And so that kind of worked out brilliantly in 1871 in the Commune. But this was the brink of revolution. And it's amazing how quickly normal bourgeois life reestablished itself in France. But you're right about Zola and stuff like that. But Zola wasn't really writing his big stuff just yet. He was sort of in the middle of the Rougon-Macquart series. Mm. He hadn't yet written like Nana or Betty and Men or any of those kind of big ones, but they were coming up, absolutely. But I think, you know, the whole realism urge came from someone like Courbet, the painter, who was intimately involved in the commune, by the way.
Carmen has always reminded me a lot of Pierre Louis's La Femme et le Pantin, which was written, I think it was 1898, I think it was written, which is also set in Seville, and it's also about a man who's desperately in love with a woman who's proving elusive.
What's her name? Remind
Conchita.
Me? Conchita, yeah.
And
Does that become an opera?
It became an opera by Zandonai, but apparently Puccini also considered setting it.
But I mean, it's clear, very clearly derived from Carmen in those senses, but she's a kind of different, third level coquette.
She's much more respectable, and the sexual aspect of it is much more not explicit. It's much more central to the narrative.
Well, she brings him in.
She leads him on,
and then she keeps him at arm's length. She won't basically put out. And he loves it.
Yes, I mean it's a bit like Zachar Masoch. Actually, it's very much of the same ilk as.
And there's a fantastic film. Fantastic. I think it was the last collaboration between Sternberg and Marlene Dietrich, called The Devil is a Woman. And this is a film of this book, La Femme et le Pantin. With Marlene as the ice princess in Seville, and you know, basically, but like all those Sternberg and Marlene films, it's kind of psychosis on celluloid. You've never seen anything like it, but it's a pure exercise in kind of style and design and psychology, but not psychology of the people, because they don't really have any. It's the psychology of the filmmaker and the psychology of the viewer. It's a kind of brilliant, but very weird and cold and rather funny piece.
And then in the 70s, Buñuel used it for The Obscure Object of Desire, when he had two actresses playing Conchita, which I think was originally, there was some practical reason why, but he ended up having a wicked Conchita and sort of good Conchita played by different actresses.
This goes back to Musset, though, doesn't it? It goes back to Alfred de Musset's obsession with, you know, the Sphinx, the femme fatale, all of this heavy brew of stuff. And of course, we do, thinking about things that echo Carmen, Musset's play, La Coupe et les Lèvres, is the basis for Puccini's second opera, Edgar,
in which
again you have a sort of the female binary and an echo of Micaela and Carmen. You have Fidelia, unsurprisingly, good girl with that name, and Tigrana, and again she's variously described, as Carmen. I think Merimée describes her or questions whether she's a Jew or a gypsy. In the Musset, it's questionable whether she's a Moor or a gypsy.
When was this written?
The play, around about 1840s, 1848, something like that.
I mean,
the opera is 1890.
Oh.
It's just before Manon Lescaut.
I mean, there is this through the whole of the kind of late 19th or middle and late 19th century, and particularly in Paris, there is this kind of frenzy about available women, right? As soon as an available woman turns up, they all go crazy, because they've constructed this society in which, I mean, we forget that the French were also Victorians. So they've constructed this unbelievably respectable society with this unbelievably unrespectable underside, which is incredibly prominent in Paris.
Well, you say it's unrespectable or disrespectable, I guess, but it's also heavily bureaucratized. Prostitution, which is, you know, the most available womanhood you can get, was sort of had about sort of 8 different definitions of certain types of prostitute. The Office of Morals, who would send out, you know, people had to be inspected for, you know, cleanliness.
If they were working in houses, but if they were streetwalkers,
no, and also if they were femme à partie. No, because then they were sort of very independent and they were basically at the top of their, no pun intended, game, courtesan and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, arguably, this is the mistake that José makes, is not dealing with Carmen through the... No, but he doesn't deal with her through the codes of prostitution, whereas everybody else does. And it works. So Escamillo does, says, you know, when's my turn? And she says, well, not just now. And, you know, I mean, you know, the whole Lilith Pastures place is basically a brothel. And the Frasquita and Mercedes in the opera are absolutely for hire.
But then we get back to realism, don't we? Yeah. Because the women who are working in the factory, they're probably not paid enough to live on. They have to do a little bit on the side. The soldiers are probably mostly too poor to get married, so they would have to be, you know,
maybe illegal.
Best living
It's often illegal for soldiers to get married in 19th century Europe. Yeah. I mean, there's an awful lot of things involved in this, yeah. But, I mean, we're talking about, because, like, who wrote this? You know, these wealthy upper bourgeois people, Mérimée and Bizet and that gang, who are in the, you know, the top 200 in Paris, the 200 de son famille and all this kind of stuff in Paris. And they can do anything they want, right? They've got their little wife at home, all very respectable and everything, and they're whoremongering the entire time. Both of them, Mérimée and Bizet, and everybody else you've ever heard of in 19th century Paris. I mean, arguably, one of the sources of the fascination and terror of sex is, of course, syphilis.
Yeah. Which would drive you mad.
And which, you know, Bizet had just done a piece with writer Alphonse Daudet from Letters from My Window Guy. They'd done La Lésienne, right? The play Bizet had written incidental music for it. It was a complete disaster, apparently. But Daudet would die of tertiary syphilis not much later. I mean, it was always hanging around there in the background. And this is the source of the fear, I think.
But if we put it back to Carmen, it's very interesting that Sean was talking about taking it into schools. When you think about all this stuff going on, what's fascinating is that opera, this supposedly exclusive, unattainable medium, sort of blends it all into this wonderful music and this gripping drama because of the music, as well as the text. And then it becomes something terribly respectable. I just find that sort of alchemy that happens.
I'm also interested in the thing about schools because I was interested in, you know, are we now presenting Carmen as a role model? And to what extent that's an appropriate idea? And we're going to talk about that next time, because now we have come to the end of the road, my dears. And it's been absolutely lovely. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.